Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. As we study and talk about the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, and search for answers as to who, what, and why, could the answers to who was behind Kennedy's murder be found in who benefited the most from his assassination? In earlier episodes, we looked at the weeks leading up to Kennedy's arrival in Dallas, which included the CIA-connected Ruth Payne, who helped Oswald get a job at the Texas School Book Depository, which overlooked Kennedy's motorcade route. Last week, we learned about Operation Northwoods, a CIA false flag plan designed to attack a prominent American target and blame Castro to justify an invasion of Cuba. It's hard to believe all that is real, but it is. But who had the motive to kill Kennedy, and who had the most to gain? First, we're going to look at the hardliners from the CIA and the military-industrial complex, who believed Kennedy had gone soft on communism and was selling the United States out to the Soviet Union. There are members of all of these groups who wanted Kennedy dead for one reason or another, and that's what we're going to look at this week.
There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound.
Were shot down by an unknown assailant wielding a possible 30-30 caliber rifle. The motorcade suddenly aborted as the President and Governor Connally pitched to the floor of their limousine covered with blood.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Attention all squads. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle. No further description at this time or information. 1245 KKB 360.
I've not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question. No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in Missouri. I'm just a patsy.
Being let out by Captain Fritz. There is the president.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's a man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot.
Mr. Oswald died at 1:07 our time in the operating room of the gunshot wound which he had received.
The first group that benefited from the assassination of JFK is the military-industrial complex. There is every indication that President Eisenhower greatly feared the CIA corporate monster that he had allowed to get so out of control during his presidency, although he had done nearly nothing to rein it in. The outgoing president devoted much of his parting speech to warning America of the dangers of the military-industrial complex.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals.
And so it is in this atmosphere that President John F. Kennedy is inaugurated in January 1961. Kennedy leaves no doubt that he rejects the certainty of war with the Soviet Union that the military and CIA is so convinced of.
If a beachhead of cooperation may push back the jungle of suspicion, let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just, and the weak secure, and the peace preserved.
But before Kennedy can begin to execute his own administration's plans for moving forward, he is confronted by the last remnants of the Eisenhower presidency. This was a plan for exiled Cuban refugees to invade the island hatched under Vice President Richard Nixon and CIA Director Alan Dulles. Here is noted author and JFK assassination expert James D. Eugenio.
With Cuba, he had already been essentially confronted with this Bay of Pigs operation, which had been set up during the Eisenhower administration. He had all kinds of questions about it, which Alan Dulles was very reluctant to answer. Well, the Bay of Pigs turned out to be a disaster. You know, it was, and in fact, the most recent scholarship on the Bay of Pigs says it was never really meant to succeed. And what was really meant to do was for it to fail, and then Kennedy would have to, under the pressure of defeat, he would then have to call in the Navy, which just happened to be in the area at that time, to save the day. Well, Kennedy didn't do that. And much to everybody's shock and surprise, he went ahead and accepted the defeat. And so after this, he did an investigation of the whole Bay of Pigs operation. And he came to the conclusion that he was snookered. And therefore, he then fired the whole top level of the Central Intelligence Agency. This was Alan Dulles. This was Dick Bissell, who was the director of plans, and Lieutenant Director Charles Cabell.
Kennedy took the initiative and began a back-channel series of letter writing with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. The letters led to each man understanding and respecting the other, and both men realized that they were each surrounded by military advisors that understood only war. It was this personal relationship between JFK and Premier Khrushchev that quite possibly saved the world from nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. The Soviets had secretly begun to build bases and deploy nuclear weapons in Cuba as a response to U.S. bases and nuclear weapons in Turkey and Italy. For 13 days, military advisors on both sides pushed for confrontation, but Kennedy and Khrushchev worked out a solution that satisfied both countries and averted a nuclear catastrophe. The world realized that the two leaders had accomplished the only logical, sane solution to one of the most dangerous times in world history. But military cold warriors like American General Curtis LeMay accused JFK of cowardice. LeMay seemed to prefer a nuclear exchange, which he felt was inevitable.
Kennedy learned a very, very difficult lesson during the whole Bay of Pigs thing, in that he learned that not to trust his advisors, that a lot of his advisors didn't have the same kind of interest that he did. So then during the Cuban Missile Crisis, again, he does not accept their advice because almost everybody wanted him to either invade the island or launch airstrikes against the missile silos. Well, he didn't either. And in fact, he went for the least provocative solution, which was the blockade. And at the same time, he had a back channel, you know, through his brother to the Russians. And that's the way the dispute was settled.
Reports that were declassified in 2017 show that the KGB held a series of emergency meetings when they heard of John Kennedy's assassination. Sergei Khrushchev, Nikita's son, wrote in a memoir about his father that when his father heard the news of Kennedy's assassination, he, quote, fell to his knees and sobbed, end quote. On November 23, 1963, a day after Kennedy's assassination, Nikita Khrushchev would release a statement that said, quote, the Soviet government and the Soviet people share the deep grief of the American people over this great loss of President John F. Kennedy, end quote. It's completely counterintuitive to think that the Soviets or the Cubans had anything to do with Kennedy's assassination. Kennedy was trying to forge a path towards peace with them. He was their great hope. The hardliners in the CIA and the military felt that Kennedy was betraying the country. He had gone soft on communism, and in order to stop its spread, you get rid of anything or anyone that stands in the way. And there was also an additional motive for Alan Dulles, the godfather of the CIA. President Kennedy had alienated much of the U.S. establishment by the time he was killed in Dallas. Kennedy alienated not only much of his own government, but the national security establishment and the military-industrial complex that was making so much money off the state of permanent war. To say they were against President Kennedy and his efforts at peace would be an understatement. Many in the establishment said that Kennedy was putting the country at risk. They thought that he was a weak president, that he was a weak leader, that he was a traitor and he had to be removed from office. In October of 1963, just weeks prior to the assassination, JFK signaled that he was going to start a withdrawal from Vietnam. This was the final nail in his coffin. When Kennedy signed National Security Action Memo 263 that stated he would pull 1,000 advisors out of Vietnam by the end of 63 and virtually all American military by the end of 65, this was too much for Dulles and the corporate titans who had run American foreign policy for the decade before Kennedy was elected. There were hundreds of millions of dollars in profit to be made by a war in Southeast Asia, and Kennedy was not going to give them that war. With the creation of National Security Action Memo 263, Kennedy had finalized his decision not to get bogged down in a war in Vietnam. After John Kennedy's assassination, National Security Action Memo 263 was reversed by National Security Action Memo 273 by Lyndon Baines Johnson, less than 72 hours after the shots rang out in Dealey Plaza. This would basically guarantee the Vietnam War. The military-industrial complex profited massively from the war in Vietnam. The estimated cost of that war was $176 billion, but more importantly, over 150,000 American soldiers died.
Don't underestimate the budget cuts that Kennedy called for in March of 63 either. Nearly 52 military installations in 25 states, 21 overseas bases. You're talking big money. You know how many helicopters have been lost in Vietnam? Nearly 3,000 so far. Who makes that? Bell Helicopter. Who owns Bell? Well, Bell was nearly bankrupt when the First National Bank of Boston approached the CIA about developing the helicopter for Indochina usage. How about the F-111 fighters? General Dynamics of Fort Worth, Texas. Who owns that? Find out the defense budget since the war began. 75, going on 100 billion. Nearly 200 billion that he spent before it's over. In 1949, it was 10 billion. No war. No money. The organizing principle of any society, Mr. Garrison, is the war. The authority of the state over its people resides in its war powers. And Kennedy wanted to end the Cold War in his second term. He wanted to call out the moon race in favor of cooperation with the Soviets. He signed a treaty with the Soviets to ban nuclear testing. He refused to invade Cuba in 1962, and he set out to withdraw from Vietnam. But all of that ended on the 22nd November, 1963. As early as 1961, they knew Kennedy was not going to go to war in Southeast Asia. Like Caesar, he is surrounded by enemies and something's underway. But it has no face, yet everybody in the loop knows.
You can forget about your combat troops. He told McNamara he is going to pull out the advisors. He f***ed us in Laos, and now he is going to damn Vietnam.
He won't implement it before the election. He can't afford to.
I hear the NSC meeting was a real barn burner.
I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Heads are going to roll everywhere. Did you hear what Lemnitzer did?
What happened?
Kennedy tried to rub Lem's nose in, saying if we didn't go into Cuba, which is so close, why should we go into Vietnam, which is so far away?
Well, there he goes again. He's got his hands on the chicken switch.
Anyway, Lem said that the chiefs still think we ought to go into Cuba.
Money's at stake. Big money. $100 billion. Kennedy brothers target voting districts for those defense dollars. They give TFX fighter contracts only to those counties that are going to make a difference in 64 and the people in the loop. They fight back. Their way.
We have to control the intelligence from Saigon.
Well, just don't let McNamara start sticking his damn nose in this thing. Every time he goes over to Saigon on some fact-finding mission, he comes back and just scares the shit out of the president. Now, I want Max Taylor on him night and day. Now, you control McNamara. You control Kennedy.
I think it started like that, in the wind. Defense contractors, big oil bankers, just conversations, nothing more. Then a call is made, maybe to someone like my superior officer, General Y.
Yeah.
We're going. We need your help.
When?
In the fall, probably in the south. We want you to come up with a plan.
I can do that.
Everything is cellularized. No one has said he must die. There's been no vote, nothing's on paper. There's no one to blame. It's as old as the crucifixion. A military firing squad. Five bullets, one blank, no one's guilty. Because everyone in the power structure who knows anything has a plausible deniability. There are no compromising connections except at the most secret point. But what's paramount is that it must succeed. No matter how many die, no matter how much it costs, the perpetrators must be on the winning side and never subject to prosecution for anything by anyone. That is a coup d'etat.
After returning from John F. Kennedy's funeral, French President Charles de Gaulle, who narrowly survived his own assassination attempt, spoke candidly to his information minister, Alan Perfetti, about his belief that JFK was killed by state security forces. De Gaulle would say, quote, "What happened to Kennedy is what nearly happened to me. His story is the same as mine. The security forces were in cahoots with the extremists," end quote. Perfetti would then ask De Gaulle, "Do you think Oswald was a front?" De Gaulle answers, "Everything leads me to believe it. They got their hands on this communist who wasn't one, while still being one. He had a subpar intellect and was an exalted fanatic. Just the man they needed, the perfect one to be accused." De Gaulle goes on to say, "Oswald only ran because he probably became suspicious. They wanted to kill him on the spot before he could be grabbed by the judicial system. Unfortunately, it didn't happen exactly the way they had probably planned it. But a trial, you realize, is just terrible. People would have talked. They would have dug up so much. They would have unearthed everything. Then the security forces went looking for a cleanup man that they could totally control and who couldn't resist their offer. And that guy sacrificed himself to kill the fake assassin, supposedly in defense of Kennedy's memory. America is in danger of upheavals, but you'll see, all of them together will observe the law of silence. They will close ranks. They'll do everything to stifle any scandal, in order not to lose face in front of the whole world, in order to not risk unleashing riots in the United States, in order to preserve the Union and to avoid a new civil war. In order to not ask themselves questions. They don't want to find out the truth. They won't allow themselves to find out the truth." End quote. Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, we'll take another look at a group who benefited from JFK's murder. The Mafia. We'll see you next week.